listener production.
I'm automotive commentator and journalist Greg Rust, and this is Rusty's Garage.
For this episode, I'm in Auckland, New Zealand at the International Motorsport, or IMS, workshop, surrounded by cool cars, both race and restoration projects, and all sorts of memorabilia with a connection to the owner. I'm here to chat with Lyle Williamson, founder and longtime team boss, who's built and prepped countless cars, worked with over 100 drivers, and helped start or guide the careers of a similar number of engineers and mechanics. As you'll hear, he's also been a driving force in a program aimed at aspiring racers for over 25 years. He's worked with several people already in our Rusty's Garage library. Craig Baird, for example. There's some good stories on Bairdo. David Brabham and Paul Morris. You'll enjoy his recollections of the late Jason Richards when he started out with IMS too. Lyle's packed more into his race life than many of us would ever think possible, running programs in South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand, and often at the same time. Little wonder this place is brimming with trophies. And he's been recognised for his success by governing bodies and big manufacturers like BMW. The winning continues, and it's as recent as the New Zealand Endurance title at the end of 2022 at Highlands on the South Island, which is where the idea of this pod was conceived. Thanks to Nick Williamson and Dan Gaunt for their intel and their encouragement. Lyle is far from done, but it's important in my books to preserve stories like this. From humble beginnings, through passion and perseverance, he achieved some incredible things and rubbed shoulders with some greats along the way. It is fantastic to try and tell a little bit of your amazing story. People may not realise you actually kicked off in Speedway and you drove in Speedway, am I right?
No, I was what they called the gopher.
The gopher.
The gopher this and gopher that. It was very early days. And down in Christchurch, I was doing my apprenticeship at the Jag agents there, Archibald's. And across the road from there was a wrecking company called City Wreckers. And he was building the old stock car that you see in the photos. And I was hanging around there all the time after school while I was also working at Archibald's. And he wanted to know if I'd go out to the Speedway with him. I couldn't go quick enough, so it started way back then.
What were the cars, the style of racing in Speedway?
32 Ford Coupe. With a little Offenhauser engine in it, V8. About the same time I'd met my wife at the beach down in Waikuku in Christchurch. So I was trying to impress her by taking her to Speedway. So she got introduced real early as well. But so she's been to all the races and the Speedway and all the things in between as well.
There's a lot of things in between. She's amazing. Hey, what I would like to understand in peeling this back a little bit is where the actual love of cars and racing comes from. Did that come from family or what attracted you to it?
Well, I'm the youngest of 11 and wow. My brothers were right into their cars, and there's photos of the cars they were restoring in a real amateur way, way back in those days. So once again, I ended up to be the gopher, so my brothers would give me little things to do every now and then and kick my butt whenever I did them wrong. So my father was also very one of those guys that polished his car every Saturday morning, and we'd all line up and get our jobs and what we were going to do. So it was quite regimented, but very amateur in those early days. Nice.
Were you good at school?
No.
You couldn't wait to get out of there, I gather, is that right?
Well, I was lucky later on in the high school that a teacher latched on to me in the engineering
side of things.
Side of it. Mm. And he gave me a lot of opportunities. We ended up fixing his old Daimler during the school time. So I was a bit lucky with that particular person. He also got me into the army, into the engineering side there, when it was compulsory training. And all that.
Mm.
So I missed all the military training, but I also got my license back in the army for trucks and things. And luckily, just some good guys picked me up in those early days when I could have got out of control.
I reckon when we were walking through International Motorsport here before, you showed me a picture of either your first car or an early car that you had or built, and you said your dad made you sell it pretty quick. Is that right? What was that car and why?
Well, it was a Model A truck, which I re-engined. I was just finished school. And dollars were burning a hole in my pocket. And I found this dreadful old truck. So I put it on the back lawn. I could see the look on my father when he came home and saw it there. So I worked away there and learned a lot, but also made some dreadful mistakes. The problem was that I didn't have the money to put hydraulic brakes on it.
Had cable brakes, did it?
So I had cable and rod brakes, and that was the death kick when I'd finished it and took it for a run. I thought to myself, wow, this thing doesn't stop too well. And my brother said, let me take it for a run. So he immediately went to Dad and said, that'll kill him. So down the road it went. Funny enough, a mate across the road bought it off me, and I think he was still trying to build it 20 years later. But she was definitely nothing to be proud of.
The apprenticeship at Archibald's was a bit sliding doors in some ways, because it exposed you to some great names in motorsport that would come in there when they came to New Zealand. Just for people that don't know, just tell them some of the names that would come in.
Well, that's where I first met Denny.
Denny Holm, we're talking.
Yes, Denny Holm, sorry. And that's a story in itself, because he was down to do the Tasman series, and Archibald used to let all the guys who come from overseas to work in their workshops. So after work, I was hanging around, hoping that I could talk or say something intelligent, which I didn't.
Were you nervous around them or not?
No, I wasn't, because I didn't really understand in those early days how lucky we were to have them just sitting there. Bruce McLaren was there.
Nice.
There's some photos in the boxes over there of how casual it all was. But in the end, Denny said to me, you want a job, kid? So I said, yes. So he said, right, can I take these wheels out into the steam cleaning bay and clean them? So I did that, and made proud as punch, brought them back. And he took a look at it, and then he kept doing his thing. So I was like a little puppy dog waiting for the next instructions. And he said, so you've cleaned them, have you? I said, yeah. And he says, really? And he says, what about these? And, of course, I cleaned the wheels, but in those days, of course, the stones would stay in those old Dunlop tyres and things, and which is what had happened here. What about these? I said, oh, I'll do those now. And he goes, no, you won't. No, if you can't do a job properly at the beginning, you can't do it at all. He said, what happens when the stones flick out and hit somebody? What happens then? Bloody useless little prick sort of thing. So left me down there. So he never spoke to me again at that time. Somehow I carried on, and I worked on over the road in the speedway stuff. And then he arrived back the next year. I thought, I'll give it another shot. So he went down there, hung around, and he looked at me and he says, have you learned how to do jobs properly yet? And I said, yeah. And he says, really? but ignored me after that. So no job, no nothing. So I stood there for, I think it was 2 days.
Hoping.
Hoping. Mm. Any rate, nothing. So I ended up at Speedway at Lady Wigram that time with Jim Slater, and he's running his XK150, and I had my white overalls on, and I was proud as punch. So I went up to Denny then and said something stupid like, "How's your racing going?" or something dumb. And he looked at me and he says, "Oh, you're working on somebody else's car." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I hope you do a better job than you did on mine." I said, "Oh, okay." So, and then after that, of course, it smoothed out, and we become good friends. And he helped me get into a professional mode at the beginning. The only other thing he said to me in those days was, "Do you want to be a driver or a mechanic?" I said, "Oh," because I didn't have a lot of driving talent, so I said, "No, I want to be a mechanic." He said, "Well, you're no bloody good to me if you want to be a driver, but if you want to be I'll help you." So from there on, of course, he stayed right till the day he died, and was quite a motivator for me to do things to a different level.
It was a very special friendship, partnership thing that you had. We'll unpack a bit more of that if we can, but a couple of things that have sprung to mind. You talked about, I think, the Jag there a moment ago. How important was working on that car for you? It taught you a lot, didn't it?
Oh, yes, because I had such good teachers. I mean, there were some amazing guys that stayed friends with us, and some of them still do to this day. Hmm. And I'm not saying I got a shortcut, but I really did, because without knowing it, I'd actually got to a different level way beyond what I was really worthy of. Mm. And these guys somehow helped.
Okay. Had you become enamoured with motor racing, you know, like, I mean, back then there's no internet, is it magazines? How were you following what they were doing when they went back to Europe and so on?
I had a friend who was getting those, and I'll show you before you leave, but that's as embarrassing as it is. All the books are in the library upstairs. And I got all those English magazines. They'd be third hand, so there's the little signatures where who got it, had to hand it on to the next. And that was keeping me reasonably up to date. But in the area where I lived down there in Spraydon, we had Ivan Major, Barry Briggs, Ronnie Moore, all in our area. And we had the Stanton brothers were just up the road, and there was another guy three or four houses along called Bobby Burns.
That's quite a roll call, quite an impressive list of, you know.
Well, they're all living in that area. And Bobby Burns was the guy who went and did the records in his big black Nightwing Vincent with a sidecar on it and things. And I'd go up there and sit and talk shit, no doubt, because I didn't really know what I was talking about. But they were all very good. They were all just in our area. Mm. So I didn't know there was anything different, really.
Mm. They called him the Bear.
Yeah.
What was he like, Denny Holm?
Well, Denny had that side to him, but there was a lot of things people didn't know about Denny, and of course his dad, Clive. And that was, it was a very tough upbringing for Denny. And Clive had been through the war and with Charles Upham, the guy who got the VC. And Denny, once he got to know you, and I did a lot of travelling with him, and there would only be the two of us in the car, and he'd tell these amazing stories of how before he could go to school, he'd get in his old Austin J truck and go down and shovel the sand into the back of the truck, and And then after school, go and take it home. And he said every now and again the axle would break because it was
so heavily laden. Wow.
And when he got home, Clive would, don't want to go exactly what happened from there, but it was
tough.
Unbelievably tough. Mm-hmm. So he stayed at our home with Joy and I. He knew Joy. Then he, once when he lost his son, then he changed as a person. He just couldn't deal with that. Mm. And he knew we'd lost our son. And he struggled with all that. And it, Greta was trying to manage things with him. And it wasn't an easy run then, but once he got near a race circuit or he'd get anywhere near a car, of course, he'd lighten up and he'd be okay. But in the dark hours when he was by himself, he loved his stationary engines and his old traction engines, and he'd just sit there for hours. And he was a world champion just playing with these little bits and pieces. And that's when he was quite at home with himself. But he was very good with me, and he got me the job, or he helped get the job in BMW. There was a lot of rivalry between Frank Gardner and Denny. And I, of course, went to Australia towards the end of Frank's running of BMW and took over the running of all that. And that was brought about through Denny opening the doors as well.
You and I would actually cross paths in the late 90s for the first time with Super Touring back in the Diet Coke era, which we'll get to. Can we talk about a couple of stories in that period where you're with Denny and some of the legends rather would come down over summer? Nick reminded me that Graham Hill somewhere had a massive accident, I think, if I've got this story right, and the car ended up in the Dunnies. Is that right? What happened there? In the shit.
Well, it was a bit different from that. What happened was there was a habit back in those days at the end of the racing is you take your sponsor and that for a run around the track and things, and New Zealand was quite
relaxed
slack.
And
this particular time at Teretonga, it had been a wet meeting and there'd been some awful narrow escapes with the guys having a lose because the surface wasn't all that drained and all the rest of it. At any rate, Faye's taken the boss of BOAC around the circuit, and he somehow just gave it a little blip in the S's, but it was enough. And, of course, the car bit and took off. It went down the bank through the fence and cleaned out the old style Dunnies that were sitting there. And everyone was, it's okay. And pushing the car and there's a few red faces, and then somebody said, "Hey, somebody in there?" And they opened the door, and here was Jimmy Clark.
Oh, Jimmy Clark.
And Jimmy was a very dapper little man and didn't like being untidy in any shape or form, and he was covered all down his legs. But it all got hushed up because although he did mention it in one of his books, but he doesn't actually say what I've just told you. But, he'd had an interesting incident down in Teretonga and he loved going to New Zealand, blah, blah, blah. But the interesting things were getting cleaned out while he was using the dunny.
Crazy. We'll come back to Denny in a second and spend a bit more time on him if we can. But let's go with some of your impressions of these absolute legends. So cool that they would come to this part of the world over the summer. I mean, Jimmy is still now with a lot of people, you know, held in that same stature as like an Ayrton Senna, or I mean, just you know, what was it like?
Well, it was... He was just in the car bay right next to us, and because I could go and talk to the mechanics and the other guys, they were just there. They weren't anything special.
Special, yeah. What was he like as a driver, though? Because, I mean, he was a special driver, wasn't he?
He was, and he was a cut above the rest. But Bruce was there with Pop McLaren, and there's some lovely photos in, back in the Archibald days before they built the new place. Mm-hmm. Archibald used to sell and service coaches and horse-drawn carts. Wow. And they had bays there, and there's a photo of Bruce and Pop sitting on the bench looking at one of the gears, which I remember it was slipping out of gear, the Cooper was. Mm. And I could just wander in and have a chat and talk with them. And because I didn't really feel anything, that I was doing anything wrong, they were as good as gold. They knew my name.
Excellent.
And luckily, most probably the word had got round, don't get him to clean any tyres because he's bloody useless. But no, I just knew around the pits areas there that I was welcome. I was never told to bugger off, but later on, of course, as I started running reasonable cars, it was a lot easier.
Yep. Let's bounce through a couple of other names. Sir Stirling Moss.
Yes. Well, there's photos out there. One of the best things, of course, was when Colin Giltrap decided to run the Golfs when they GTIs when they first come out, and I ended up getting pulled in with Rod Coppins and Jerry Clayton and Jack Brabham, Stirling Moss and Denny Holm were the team. Well, that's quite a team, but once again, it didn't mean anything to us because it was just a job and that's what we had to do. But Stirling had a lot more urgency to him. But he wanted things done his way and quickly. Then he would used to not belittle him, but he'd say, just ignore him, just do what we're doing. Don't worry about what he's doing. He won't know.
Yeah.
But it was in a nice way. It wasn't nasty stuff.
You would have an association with Jeff and David Brabham later on in Super Touring. What about Sir Jack? What was Sir Jack like?
Yeah, he was a hard old boy.
Was he?
Yeah. Well, look, Denny and Jack fell out years and years ago, and it was actually at Bob Jane's Quarter Park that we managed to get Jack and Denny to talk. I never pressed Denny to know what caused the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But we were in having breakfast, and I said, "There's Jack." And he goes, "Yeah, I can see." "Well, why don't you go and say something?" He goes, "No fucking way, I'm not going to know, man." Anyway, the second day, I said, "Come on, just can't hurt." So he did. And Jack was very welcoming. And next minute, I thought, gee, he's drawn up a seat. And he sat there at the breakfast table and muttered about a whole lot of things that they'd been doing. And it was never mentioned again about whatever the problem was. But that's when they first started to talk again.
Okay. Yeah. You've kept lots of lovely stuff of Denny. When I walked in here today, you showed me, I think, even a tyre pressure gauge from the very early part of his career. Is that right?
That's Clive. When Denny went away and won the trip to Europe, Clive gave him the gauge, and it was in a little case, and Denny never used it, I don't think, but he was very proud of it.
Yep.
But he also, when he gave it to me years and years ago, it was, "You look after this, and preferably don't use it." And every now and again he'd say, "Where's that gauge?" So I'd have to go and show him and make sure that it was still in that condition. But he did that with a lot of things over the period of time. He was not miserly, but he was very tight with his dollars. And those days I was down in Khyber Pass and I'd started a bicycle shop and a chain, and it grew and grew and grew. So the race team got shoved out the back of Khyber Pass down there. And then he would come in and look for Joy and say, "Where's Joy? Where's Joy?" And he'd open up a little plastic bag and it would have some money in it. And he'd say, "Can you go and put it?" Because the, next to the where the race shop was ASB Bank. Yep. And she'd have to go and put these odd amounts of money into these accounts. And he could always see him, he's looking at his book and adding it up. But he had small things, not amused him, but he enjoyed just small, normal things.
Yeah.
He knew we had Joy being a traditional West Coaster. We'd have roast dinner on Sunday nights always, and still to this day, funny enough, whenever we're around. And Denny would always rock up and know that he's going to get a roast on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
At that stage, his life was still being difficult. He hadn't settled down again, but he was always welcome around us.
What was he like as a driver? Because, I mean...
He was so, not brutal, but he just did it with it all being so easy, and he'd be chatting to you. And he just, smooth, he knew the car, he knew what he needed from it. He didn't make a fuss, unless it was wrong. And then old Jandals or me would get it in the neck big time. But overall, he was struggling when we were working with Peter Brock in the Gold Corp cars, because he reckoned the Commodore was not an easy car to do what the Australians were managing to do with it. But he got in there and did the job that he needed to do, but he didn't really like it.
Okay. Is there a car along the way in that period? I mean, Murph recounted to me recently about getting the chance to drive the Yardley McLaren, for example.
Yes.
and sharing that. Was there a car that Denny drove, or was there a car even in that period that you fondly remember that you felt a special maybe attachment or connection to?
Well, it's not going to be the answer that you would expect.
Okay.
So he used to do a lot of mileage backwards and forwards to Rotowiti and to here, and that was just the mood he was in at that period of time. Jaguar had built him a very special XJ, which is well documented in that, and it's in a collector's hands now. He had his Range Rover. He later on had his BMW when we were working with BMW. Every time he came to Auckland, he'd be in this Chevette, bloody 800, 900cc. And I say, "Oh, mate, I'm not putting mileage on those." He used to talk to the bloody thing.
Really?
Yeah, he'd be, "Don't you talk about my Chevette. She's good, aren't you?" Really? And it wasn't a pride and joy thing. It was
connection.
This is this car up and down, up and down, up and down. Because I can imagine sometimes when he must have been going down the highway and he'd go past somebody and they'd look out the window and say, "Geez, that guy looks like Denny Hart. Can't be him because he's in this little red Chevette." But that's what he loved. Special race cars, not really. He knew the insides of them. There's another nice thing that happened way back then. We ended up befriending Alan Hamilton when Alan had the Porsche bits and pieces, and he had the 917 Porsche that Alan restored, and we ended up at his place, and then he was having a good look around and he said, oh, Jesus. And Alan was saying, oh, we had you licked in the Can-Am days with this and all the rest of it. And then he would say, oh, yeah, you reckon, did you? How many did you win compared with us? then he said something unusual. He said, we were standing there, and there's a photo of this around somewhere too. He said, you know, we always knew how to beat you guys. And he bends down and he looks at the back of the car and he said, oh, this one's had it done too. What? And he said, these cars carry the oil and the water inside the tube frame and they built the cars out of aluminium. So we knew to get on the back and give it a tap and it would start leaking. I said, is that for real? And he goes, yeah. I said, what?
Amazing.
And you should have seen old Alan Hamilton. You wouldn't have done that, no, really, would you? Bloody oath we would, he said. So that was a humorous part
of course.
When he's not a man that has a lot of humour, but he giggled away about that.
Good. Couple to finish on him if we can. Nick said to me, which more or less underscores what Denny was like, I think on his first kind of serious go-kart outing, Denny came and supported and spectated, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Amazing.
But I think he got on better with the kids than he did with adults. Yeah. He seemed, especially if it was a family thing, that he would put a bit of time into them when he didn't need to. Mm. But the same problem happened there where he... we didn't, like Nick wouldn't have thought it was any different. Because he was sometimes he was sleeping in the room next door at our home anyway. Yeah. It's just Denny.
Mm. Paul Morris has been on the podcast and a couple of others and shared their recollections of the day he passed at Bathurst.
Yeah.
How did that affect you, mate?
Well, That was the weekend. I was supposed to be over there with Denny and Frank, but the Germans arrived out to New Zealand to look at this proposal of running this new race team and how we were going to run it and how it was going to work and all the rest of it.
So Denny, when you say German, you mean BMW, obviously.
BMW Motorsport, Paul Roscher and another guy. So they said, he said, look, it's better that you stay and do the deal. And I wasn't in a hurry to go to the race meeting anyway. But I knew he was not struggling, but I said, are you okay? And it just got, I'm just tired or overloaded. So nothing really was
standing out.
Kind of out. Mm. So I'm at home with Joy watching it on TV and I see the incident and I see the car going down and veering off to the right. And then I said to Joy, gee, there's something wrong there. And then I saw people getting into action. And then my phone rang and Tim Schenken said, are you watching this? And I said, yeah. And he said, he's gone.
Oh, my goodness. It'd take you a long time to get over that, mate, given how long you'd known him. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to make you upset. Yeah. The thing in the early part of your dealings with him where you talked about him being tough on you about the rocks and the tyres and stuff, ironically, mate, it was a great life lesson that kind of set all this up where we are today. Because you've talked about how your kind of philosophy or your approach in this business, which has been so successful for whatever it is 60-odd years, has been: if the preparation is meticulous, if you do a good job in the background, and then if you work and find the right drivers, the success will come. So he kind of started a bit of that in you, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. Well, there was quite a few. Like at Archibald Stew, it was very strict. And old English mechanics who, one of them I worked under, he came from the Jaguar Racing Department and he immigrated to New Zealand. Mm. And it's like I mentioned before, I was quite lucky where sometimes I got put with people just through no real special reason. I wasn't anything special either. So those things happen. But with Denny, he didn't compromise. He was, that's the way I want it done, and if you don't do it that way, and I'm sure if you ask the boys out in the workshop,
they now.
Drives us nuts. But that's just my way. Mm. And, you know, I've had over, in the records there, there's about 120-odd mechanics who have been through here and worked with me. Because we've had some big teams over the period of time. Mm. Where, so a lot of them now you see overseas working, all had their beginnings way back in those early days with IMS. Mm. And the same as the amount of drivers that we've had, like that's over 100 drivers. And then I got involved with the Motorsport New Zealand's Academy, and I'm one of the founders of that. So I've been with that for 22 years now. Mm. And that's also at about 100 and something odd. So I've had quite a lot of people work under my influence and work in the team and still stay friends to this day.
Yeah.
And I must admit I get more enjoyment out of that than I do out of watching the young ones coming up.
Do you?
Knowing that I got a bit of a break way back in those early days of my apprenticeship, and I try to do at least one apprenticeship every 2 or 3 years. We're just changing over now, as I mentioned.
Amazing.
Where Connor Adams, we've had in the Toyota 86s and in the Porsches.
Porsche, yeah.
He's just finished his apprenticeship and a new guy is just starting who's reminds me a lot of me, that he's a bit awkward. He's not the flashiest Harry, but I can see something in him, as I have with all the guys. And we've been fortunate to have some very good guys who have worked with us.
Hi there, could I just give you a bit of direction? If you are getting plenty out of this chat, you have to head into the garage and take a listen to Rusty's sit down with another successful team owner in Ross Stone.
My question is a little bit loaded here, okay? I'm probably talking a bit out of school, but Anna told me on the quiet she can remember driving home on the Monday, family's in the car, and you turned around and you said, we're going to make it.
Yeah, well, it was hard because there was $100,000 if you win Bathurst, you know, and that was massive to us. Just, you know, you don't get any now, you get the start money and all that sort of stuff, but winning that $100,000 was just massive and really helped us. And winning Bathurst also helped us with Ford because, you know, there was other guys in there and they were doing a good job too, you know.
Changes the you're already very well known, already very very well established in that pit lane. But when you're a Bathurst winner, and then you'd ultimately go on and win championships as well, but the cachet goes to another level, Ross, doesn't it?
Well, I always used to say in supercar racing, if you're doing today what you're doing a month ago, you're not going to be good enough. So you had to keep reinventing yourself and just keep working. And I think Jimmy always set the standard for the amount of work that was going on, you know.
They are a special breed. Now, back to Rusty.
We love the contest, we love the racing, we love the cars, whatever, but it becomes a people game. So at what point did you get good at picking the right people to come work, either drive for you or work for you, and did that come easily?
It did, actually. I sound conceited saying that, but I just worked with some amazing people early on, and then slowly those people were coming to work with me, and we've been very lucky that we've always had people wanting to work with us. You know, we worked in South Africa with Craig Baird, and our mechanics went over there. I've done a fair amount of time in America.
Australia too.
Australia. And luckily, because of the teams that I've been running and working with, we've ended up with real good mechanics down this end of the world in Australia and New Zealand. We are so lucky on the standard of people. They come in not knowing a lot, but boy, after a couple of years, they're onto it.
Am I right in saying too that you were very active in encouraging Paul Sepranich to come to this part of the world, to Australia, didn't you? So you obviously saw him in South Africa, and how did that all sort of start?
The first year when there was a bit of a mess in BMW when I first went over there, and Frank had been struggling, and the fire had gone out, and everyone, the Morrises were holding it together. So I moved over there. I was keeping International Motorsport running here. So I promoted one of our guys, and I thought I was bulletproof, but I sure in hell found out quick that I wasn't as good as I thought I was. But trying to do Australia and New Zealand at the same time. And where were we up to?
You're talking about Sepranich, Paul Sepranich.
So Rudy Miner came out to Australia. He's one of the leading lights under Paul Roscher, who runs the BMW Motorsport programs. And he said, show me what you're going to do. So I said, well, first I've got I don't know what the budget is. He said, just put it together, whatever it is. He said, you're going to need to move away from the people that Frank's had. You know, we need better quality. So we made this list up, and he said, I want to ring a couple of guys. So he said a couple of months later, right, I want you to go to South Africa and meet Peter DeVar, who's the boss of BMW Motorsport. He's also got a guy there called Paul Sepranich. And then I want you to go to Europe and go to France and interview Eric Ferron, who was the guy who came from Renault Formula One through to Australia for that year that we were quite successful. And so I went there and met Peter DeVar. He just said, better be careful what I say here, but anyway, I met Paul. Paul was a bit ho-hum. He wanted to go to Australia, but he certainly didn't want to go and work with somebody, a little Kiwi. He didn't know what he was up to. But we ended up to be good friends, and of course we had a successful year. Eric Ferron and Paul didn't get on that well, so Eric didn't renew his contract for the following year, where Paul was on a mission. He wanted to use that as a stepping stone, and he was always going to go to greater things. He knew where he was heading. But back then, of course, the Diet Coke BMW team was starting to mould into a very, very good team. In fact, Australia, as you know, was struggling to allow the 2 litres run against the V8s and all the rest of it. So I got sent to Japan to have a look about going to set up a BMW Motorsport race team as we had in Australia over there. But at that stage, Joy was looking at me sideways, and
you were already busy enough.
New Zealand was struggling, so luckily I didn't go ahead with it, and I think it was 2 seasons later they closed that down too, so I'm pleased I didn't.
Ironically, with the success of the Diet Coke BMWs in that chapter where you were with them, you were up against Audi, and now you're running Audis here at International Motorsport, which we'll get to. We'll get to a little bit later. Can we just we've skipped forward a fraction, which is okay, but let's just go back two steps if we can. Firstly, there is one photo of you outside that I spotted at the wheel of a car, an open wheeler.
Oh yes.
Is it a Lotus? What are you in there? I'm trying to remember what that is.
Yes, a little Lotus.
Tell me about that.
After Archibald's and the Speedway, there was a car enthusiast in Christchurch who owned a big electrical company called PDL. And I used to be the man, old Bob, if he needed to be run back to work, he would...
go with you.
Get Williamson, so I'd do that and he'd chat away. So what are you going to do? I said, oh, one day I'll get out there and do my own motor racing sort of thing, and babbled away, and he was patient enough to put up with me. Anyway, I don't know how many years it was, maybe 2 years I was running him back. He said, you've been watching our motor racing? I said, yeah, that's cool, isn't it? And he was racing two Minis and a little Robat Mantis, a little Lotus 7 thing.
Yep.
And he said, well, when you decide to move, you give me come down and we'll see if there's a role for you. I couldn't wait. I think I went in that same week and thinking, I don't know what I was thinking, I'd go to the receptionist and said, I want to see Bob Stewart. And the girl saying, you? Who are you? Anyway, luckily Bob did, when they rung through, he did recognise that there was something. So anyway, I was hired immediately. So then I had the problem of resigning from Archibald's. But I had not remembered that my apprenticeship wasn't finished.
Oh.
So that caused a few headaches. And so I managed to be able to get my apprenticeship finished when I moved to the other place, even though I didn't have a senior man over me. But I only had a small amount of time to go. So I then ended up, Bob was starting his car collection and he put me onto his old Aston DB4, which was a restoration job that had been half finished. And then there was a bit of a split going on between a lovely old mechanic down there, Eric Johnson from Automotive Maintenance, and... Eric was struggling to keep up with Bob's wishes to build a proper race team and all the rest of it. And Eric was the old school, similar to what I was, but I most probably was a bit more modern than that. So I did the last couple of races with Eric and the Minis, and then... with the instructions from Bob, sell the Minis, we're going to go to V8s. And that was when my life really started to take off. So Clyde Collins, who we lost just a few months ago, he was the driver in those days, along with Robert Stewart, who was Boss's son. And Clyde and I got underway with this burnt out 69 Falcon and the race shed underneath. And what were we thinking? Like, this car was it was all wrinkled where the heat had been through it and all the rest of it. And Bob had a bit of patience with us for maybe a month or two. And he one day he said, just stop. What are you guys thinking? And we said, well, this is all we can afford to do. So at any rate, he went upstairs, and I think he said over the many years later, he thought he'll just pick up the phone and ring Ford Motor Company. So the boss then was Ren Penny, and he said, I want to do this. And Ren said, oh, okay, you know how you're doing it all. Yeah. So one day I was told to wear tidy clothes and all the rest of it. We go down to Hutchison Motors, and Wren was, he knew Bob Stewart was direct and to the point, and said, right, what do you want? Well, Bob said, I want XW Falcon, and I want, you can have your name on it, and it's going to have PDL, and but you're going to give it to me and blah, blah, blah. And Ren said, oh, sure, I don't know about that. But, of course, Ford did give us the car in the end, and we went on and built that overweight Falcon, run it for a couple of years, but knew we couldn't beat the Mustangs.
Yep.
And the Mustang to beat was Paul Fahey, who had a 70 Boss Mustang with mm-hmm. all the Bud Moore stuff on it. And it was speeding up in those days because Bob wanted to get faster and get better results. So it ended up the very short term, a time that we were owned a Bob, the Mustang of Fahey's.
Yeah.
It a lot of people don't know the next part that I'm going to tell you, but Paul wasn't fussed about me being there. He wanted Ray Stone, who was a very good mechanic and running his cars in those days. And Bob said, no, no, he's staying and we're running it, sort of thing. So I go to Bay Park to pick it up, and we picked immediately when I got there. There was a lot of animosity between Jack Naser and Paul, and there'd been a bit of contact and things like that. And it was race two, and there's a big puff of smoke, and the cars, the Mustang stops, and it comes, toes back in to the pits, and I said, geez, well, what's going on now? And they said, oh, I don't know. Well, it's okay, it's just something small. So I had a look around it, and I could see there was a hole in the block.
Whew.
And it had one of the very special engine called a J-block, which was when they put the 377 engines in the GT40s, they made these J-blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a hole through it. So I have to ring Bob Stewart to tell him that the money's ready to be transferred and all the rest of it. So I ring Bob. Yeah, what's it like? Yeah, he's so enthusiastic. I said, we got a bit of a problem. He goes, like what? I said, he's blowing the engine. He's what? Oh, no, just come home. So I said, oh, okay. So Fahey gets on the phone to Bob and said, look, that's no big deal. I don't know what he's told you, but we'll fix it all and it's all okay. Well, of course, it never was okay. And while there's a lot of versions of how PDL or how Bob and Fahey fell out, that's the reason why they fell out, is because in the season and a bit that Paul drove for us, he never fixed the engine and we never saw the engine again. We found out years later it got taken to America and repaired, and it was so valuable that it was used in a GT40.
Wow.
So the reason why there was a lot of problems back then was because the day we got the car, we had a blown engine in it. Mm. And it took a while. We then had to do our own engine, and Murray Bunn from Auckland, he was helping us, and he was saying, mate, you're not going to get this GT40 engine back. And what it was is one of the little heavy steel weights that go in the crank came out and got caught between the block and the crankshaft as it spun round and just punched a hole out the side of it.
I want to break into the conversation for just a moment. Lyle's made a bit of a revelation here. As always with Rusty's Garage, it's the guest in their words, but I'm also a huge believer in balance, and Paul isn't here to offer his version of events, so we need to keep that in mind. His opinion may be different. He's a legend who's carved a special place in the history books with his achievements in saloon cars in New Zealand in the 60s and early 70s. So perhaps read the book Lyle refers to and then consider his recollections that we've just shared and then form your own view. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
The other thing that happened back then is Paul insisted that he wanted Ray Stone to work with us for the first few meetings, and Bob wasn't having a bar of that. But at the same time, Joe Wright, who was Graham McRae's mechanic, was floating a bit, waiting to go back to the Formula 5000 series in America, and he didn't have a job. So I liked Joe because he was an unbelievably casual, real clever Kiwi mechanic. Mm-hmm. So he did the season with us, and some of the season with us before he went back. And there was the stories in the Fahey book that we didn't know how to do the setups and anything like that. Well, that's none of that was true. All it was is that we'd been force-fed the wrong tyres and we were struggling to run the car as fast as had run the season before, mm-hmm. because we had been fitted in using tyres that weren't designed to do New Zealand and all the rest of it. And Joe Chamberlain, the old Camaro guy who was out from the States, Bob Stewart somehow was chatting away to him, and Chamberlain came down and had a look at the car, and oh, that car's a cracker of a car. What? So what? Oh, hang on, what are you doing with those tyres? Well, that's what we were told. And, of course, Bob, being the man that he was, he immediately hit Fahey up and said, you've fitted me. And it was a very – it's the only time in my life I've really had quite a difficult relationship, and it wasn't nice working there. We were trying to do well, but it was – a nasty part of life. And, of course, later on we got the Mustang going, we raced Moffat, we raced...
Jimmy Richards would have been a part of...
Jim's car came a year later, but we did the Trans-Tasman Cup, and the trophies around here somewhere. Mm-hmm. And the car did over 100 race wins in our hands. Each year we prided ourselves on wanting to go faster, which I teach these guys here. No point in doing the same lap times you did last year. You've got to inch ahead. So that was quite
your drivers back then, was it Leo Leonard? I'm trying to remember who was.
Graham Baker came first. Yeah. He was driving a Formula Ford, mm-hmm. and Bucky and I go way back along with Clyde Collins. And then Dave Baker came on board to drive that car. Leo, of course, we went to Australia with that, and then we decided that we would build Mustang 2. Mm-hmm. And once again, thought we were bulletproof and soon found out we weren't. But okay. The car was built to a high level and still is to this day. But that's all New Zealand built. It's been hacked around a few times lately, but the original car was a cracker of a car, and there was three real good mechanics, fabricators back in those days. Who made that car.
Yeah. Cheeky Andy McElroy sent me a message and said you didn't give his dad a Guernsey. Is that right? Is that right?
he just sent me something this morning and he said, I said, good to see your success, and I've known the family. Rod, we used to race against his dad. I said, your dad would be so proud of you. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, but you're the one that taught us how to cheat.
Oh, is that what he said?
Yeah. And I said, oh, yeah, well, I thought you knew pretty well before you got to me, coming from Timaru. What did he say? He replied, yeah, well, there's more to be said. He said.
Stirring. Good stirring. Hey, while we're in this phase, we raised Jimmy Richards a minute ago. Was there a little rally story involving you two that you can share, you and Jimmy? Have I got that right? Or a rally story involving you? I'm trying to remember. Did you go rallying at some point?
How on earth did you find that out?
Come on, share with it.
I think what you might be talking about is I was in the Astley Forest and I knew Jim pretty well and we were doing a little bit of rallying back in those days too. So standing with a few people, they were doing drives up through the Astley Forest. Mm. And I don't know how you found that out. Anyway, he saw me there and he said, come on, get in. I said, no. I've been in race car drivers. They love to scare the living daylights out of you. If you're the one that's been telling them they can't drive properly, once they get you in that car, you're away. So anyway, I end up going into the end of the forest and I'm so sick. And I've changed colour, my hand's shaking. And we get there and he, of course, then you're going to have to go out and back out again. So I get out of the car. He said, come on, we're going to go. Are you all right? And I'm spewing. And I said, no, I'll walk. He goes, don't be fucking stupid. You can't walk. Anyway, he said, I'll just go a little bit slower. And I said, I won't tell anyone. I said, oh, yeah, right here. So he goes faster going back out because I had to wait till all the cars come up and then they wait and send them back out again. Mm-hmm. He gets out of the car and some of our race team people are there. And, of course, he's cracking up and saying, can't smell him. He's been spewing all over the show. So that's what happened.
Absolutely love yarns like that. And how good were the stories on Denny Holm too? I ended up hanging on every word of those. Don't forget, Jimmy Richards is in our library too. If you haven't heard that one, I hope you find the time when you've finished this episode. That's the end of part one of my pod with respected team owner Lyle Williamson. There's lots of great stuff still to come. Part two is all loaded up and ready for you to hit the gas on right now. From a cheeky Craig Baird who basically wore him down to a young Jason Richards who was equally determined to drive for IMS. And the high-stakes Bathurst drama that was both a win and a loss in equal measure.